Seems a shame to close the meeting. The audience gets getting bigger every night. We are so grateful for those of you who have attended in the nights past, and some of you have been here practically every night of this meeting. And that's a thrill to me. And I know it's a thrill to the brethren here. But I do appreciate your attention tonight. I'll do the best that I can. We've preached in this meeting since Lord's Day, talked about learning to think like the Lord and to saturate our minds with the revelation of God, that we can learn to think as God thinks about things. We talked about the truth about Jesus concerning who he was. That was simply a study of the miracles that are found in the book of John, by reason of which John made one argument, that these show you that he is the Christ, he is the Son of God. Believing on him, you can have life. Later that evening, we talked about Jesus and a man with the naked name of Nicodemus, one who came because he had seen the signs that Jesus had done, was convinced of who he was, to a degree at least. And we went through the study of the first 21 verses of the book of John and pointed out how Nicodemus was probably the first to hear the greatest announcement the world ever heard. And that was that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Monday night we talked about the power of the resurrection and how it changes things, and how everything that is worthwhile in the book of God and in our lives hinges around that thing called the resurrection. Tuesday night we talked about a time when the gospel apparently failed, when it was preached unto a man by the name of Felix, who was a reprobate and a man of just such spiritually bankrupt character. But the Lord made an attempt to reach him through Paul, and a sermon that consisted of righteousness, self-control, and judgment. Felix rejected, and he finds himself standing now with the likes of Pharaoh and Judas and a whole lot of others. But the gospel didn't fail, as it never does, because it will touch the hearts of those who are inclined toward wanting to do right. Wednesday night we tried to talk about developing the potential of brethren, and talked about that for some while. Last night we talked about building strong churches, and if you wonder what that sermon was all about, read Acts chapter 20, where Paul begins his speech to the Ephesian elders, and just go right down to the close of the chapter. The strong churches were taught churches. They were made up of people of conviction. They were vigilant with regard to those who would seek to lead them astray, and on over and above all that, they cared for one another with a love and devotion the likes of which the world had never seen. That's what makes a church strong. Tonight I want to talk, and I'm going to be somewhat tied to my notes tonight. I haven't had a whole lot of time today to do otherwise. And when I get down to about page 4, we'll be finished. I probably won't talk about everything there, but I will be kind of tied to them, so just bear with me. And we'll talk for a little while on a thing called perseverance or steadfastness, or just the idea of keeping on with what it is that we're trying to do as Christians. Webster defines perseverance as the act or quality of perseverance or persistence. It is the steadfast pursuit of an undertaking or aim. It is to go on resolutely in spite of opposition. There are a number of terms that are used in the New Testament, but the one that we will consider most tonight is the one that has to do with steadfastness or constancy, that thing that is constant. And in the New Testament, it is the characteristic of a man who is unswerved from his deliberate purpose and his loyalty to faith and piety by even the greatest of trials and suffering. It is rendered patience in some translations, mostly the King James. The American Standard will have it rendered by the term of steadfastness. And Paul said in Romans chapter 5, being therefore justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained our access by faith into this grace wherein we stand, and we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. And not only so, but we rejoice in tribulation also, That word tribulation there comes from a word which means to be pressed between two. It's under pressure. And he said, we rejoice in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh steadfastness. Steadfastness worketh approvedness, and approvedness hope. And that's the whole story of the life of the child of God. He will face adversities through which he must prove his steadfastness by cleaving to the Lord regardless. When he proves his steadfastness, or when he comes through them victoriously, he will have steadfastness, and that steadfastness will work his approvedness before God, and when he attains the approval of God, then he has the hope that God has promised. A whole lot more could be said about those things, but that will basically give you an idea that we're talking about. Paul said again in Romans chapter 8, for in hope we were saved. What a man seeth, why did he yet hope for? But if we hope for that which we see not, then we do with steadfastness wait for it. And he's in that portion of the book of Romans in which he's encouraging the brethren that regardless of what the trial or the adversity is, nothing can compare with the glory that is to be revealed unto us. Now then, let's look at some illustrations of perseverance and steadfastness. First of all, in some scripture references, just a couple of stories. First of all, the one about the woman in Luke chapter 18. The Lord is teaching a lesson on persistence in prayer in order to accomplish things. And he tells about this woman who had a grievance, and she went to an unjust judge, a judge who feared not God and he cared not for man, and she laid her case before him and he rejected her. But she continued going to him, and finally he said, lest she weary me with her constant coming, I'm going to satisfy her case. And consequently he did. Now, Jesus told that story to illustrate persistence in prayer. But the idea is that this woman accomplished what she wanted to accomplish, even when everything seemed against her being able to accomplish it, because she never gave up. She wore the man down, if you will, and accomplished her goal. Persistence, perseverance. There's another case in the 15th chapter of the book of Matthew when Jesus has gone over into the coast of Tyre and Sidon, and there he meets a Canaanitish woman who comes to him with a proposition that she has a child that is sick and needs help, and he doesn't pay attention to her. And the disciples say, send her away. And she asks him again, and he said, it's not really right for us to take the children's food and give it to dogs. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had been that woman, that would have been a very discouraging phrase. But she looked at him and she said, dogs will take the crumbs from the master's table. The Lord looked into her and said unto her that her faith had saved her, and her request was granted and the child was made well. This woman persisted, she persevered in the one thing that she wanted and she needed the most from the one in whom she believed could accomplish that, and she gained what she wanted. So we're talking about perseverance, or steadfastness. If you look at it from the standpoint of just secular things, T.J. Watson, who was one time the president of IBM, was interviewing a young man who had lamented and complained, literally, about the failures that he was having because, and I don't recall now how he got an interview with T.J. Watson. That's part of the thing that I didn't write down and I've forgotten. But when he lamented to Watson about the failures that he'd had, nobody wanted to print the things that he wrote, and he just said, I just don't know what to do. And Watson looked at him and said, well, son, you had one thing to do. He said, double your rate of failure. In other words, quit. Don't quit. Just keep sending them in. One of these days, somebody's going to latch on to that thing and publish it. When they asked James J. Corbett how to become a champion, he said, just fight one more round. And the story that I told last night to illustrate what I was going to talk about tonight almost had its fulfillment in the Janik boys that lived over here. And when I lived on Akron View Drive and the snows came and drifted around the driveway, they would always come up and shovel me out. One of them had just a little shovel. And I remember the story that I heard about a man who was approached by a little boy who said, I'll shovel your sidewalk for a dollar. And he looked at him and he said, well, how are you going to move snow with that little shovel? He said, by keeping at it. And that's what they did. They just kept at it until the snow was gone. They got some hot chocolate and a couple of dollars, and everybody was happy, and I could get out of the driveway. Napoleon at Waterloo was defeated by the Duke of Wellington, and the Duke of Wellington said of that occasion, "My soldiers were not braver than Napoleon's soldiers. They were only brave for 5 minutes longer." Do you hear it? Persistence, steadfastness. And one by the name of Dag Hammarskjöld, who was one time Secretary General of the United Nations, made this statement. He said, when the freshness of morning has been replaced by the weariness of midday, when the leg muscles quiver beneath the strain, the climb seems endless, and sometimes nothing will go as it should, it is then that you must not hesitate. We're just talking about things that are said which illustrate the idea of perseverance. And it is an absolute essential, ladies and gentlemen, that you and I, as servants of the God, understand that this is the fundamental principle of our success in the gospel. It is the idea of just keeping on with what we're doing. In Luke 9 and verse 18 through 27, I'm going to pick up about verse 23. I was looking right at this passage the other night, couldn't see it, and stumbled around, and a brother went out the door and said, "George, you were looking right at it. How could you miss it?" Well, we'll not look at it tonight. We'll just say it's there and we'll quote it. But Jesus said, "If any man will come after me, let him take up his cross daily and follow me." Remember what I said about that? And it's all important. The idea here of the cross is not just some burden. We all have burdens, and we speak sometimes of this is the cross that we have to bear. But here Jesus is talking about something else. This is a cross that you can pick up or you can let it lay. The cross of responsibility. The cross of commitment. And he says, if you want to follow me, you take up your cross daily and follow me. And you do it one day at a time. And that's the concept, ladies and gentlemen, of steadfastness. And you look at the language of Paul in the conclusion of that great resurrection chapter, when he said in 1 Corinthians 15, "Wherefore, beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Did you hear it? Steadfast, unmovable, always abounding, you know your labor is not going to be in vain. In Galatians, he said that as a man, the God is not mocked, as a man sows, that's how he will reap. The one who sows to the flesh shall of the flesh receive corruption, but he that soweth unto the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And he said, and understand that in due season we shall reap if we faint not. There's the idea of the persistence again. And finally, Paul's statement in the Philippian letter, beginning in chapter 3, when he talked about all that he had for going for him in Judaism and how he counted it all as worthless for what he could gain in Christ, he made this statement beginning in chapter 3 and verse 13. "Brethren, I count not myself yet to have laid hold, but one thing I do, forgetting the things which are behind." Now stop there for a minute. Paul had just elaborated on all that he had going in Judaism, and he said, "I look upon this, and it's worth nothing, but it's not even fit for the dunghill. But I remember that, and I forget it now, and I look now to the things that are before." You say to me, "Brother Lamar says, how in the world can I forget all of the hardship things that I had to face and have had to face?" You can't. You can't get them out of your memory. I can remember mine, you can remember yours. But I'll tell you one thing you can do, you can let them lay in yesterday where they belong. And then he said, looking forward to the things that are before. That's the important thing. It's what it is that's coming. He said, and with this, I press on toward the goal. And that word press is the idea of just stretching to the very fiber of your being. He said, I press on toward the goal of the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Then his conclusion, let as many as would be mature be of the same mind. You want to understand steadfastness? Look at the life of Paul. Look at what he had to forget. Look at what he had to face and how he used each day just to press on to it. Follow that. He said, those who would be mature, those who would reach maturity in Christ, let them be of the same mind. Now then, the problem is when we talk about perseverance and steadfastness, There are two factors that we frequently forget about, and yet they're absolute imperatives when you're talking about this. And the one is adversity, and the other is failure. Now, when I use the word failure, it sounds like, well, we're just given license to have so many failures, and it really doesn't matter. That's not the point. But these two things, adversity and failure, look how they work. Paul Harvey one time made the statement, the doers of great things need the humbling effects of adversity. Did you hear it? The humbling effects of adversity. This was in a speech that he made with regard to the astronauts in our space program, and many of them had to overcome a lot of physical debilitation and physical hardships before they could qualify and then to succeed as an astronaut. Now, I'm talking about something far more important than that. But the statement that he made, we need the humbling effects of adversity. When things come along, ladies and gentlemen, that seem in opposition to us, these are the things that make us or break us, and we need them because they humble us. I've never seen a proud man at a funeral, and I've always seen humble people as the people who have stood the times of trial. We could talk about Helen Keller, born mute and blind, and with the help of her mentor was able to overcome that. I don't care what your politics is, but Franklin Roosevelt overcame a great deal when he was suffered polio. But I want to talk to you about a fellow that's more local. Some of you may remember him or know him. He was a member of the church in Cuyahoga Falls. His name was Bruce Thomas. Bruce is a boy down in Tennessee. He fell into the fireplace in his home. I don't remember all the details that his wife told me about this. But in this fire, he was severely burned and he lost his sight. After he was healed, the people in the town where he lived looked disdainfully upon his mother because of the way she treated him. She insisted that he learn to fend for himself. He was blind, his sight was gone, he had lost one of the things that we treasure the most, and yet she insisted, you learn to fend for yourself. When I knew Bruce, he was running for and became mayor of Cuyahoga Falls. But that's politics. I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk to you about something that he did with a store that he had. I can't remember when he started it, but while I was living in the falls, he had an appliance store. Now, this is a blind man, and he had an appliance store. And we needed a washer. We didn't have much of anything else, but we needed a washer. And I said to the wife, well, let's go down and talk to Brother Thomas. Now, let me make a point here. We always talk about, well, let's go down and deal with his brother. He'll make us a good deal. He'll shave it to where he doesn't make very much, and I'll make a good deal. Did you ever think about going to deal with a brother and think, he's my brother, I'll give him a little more? I know one brother who was put out of business because he favored the brethren so much, his profits are gone. Now then, went down to see Bruce. He had all of these appliances set up in a certain way in his store. Reason, I'm blind. I have to know where they are if I'm going to tell people about them. And we told him what our situation was. Well, George, let's go look and see what we have. Look and see, Bruce? Well, how about that? Bruce and another fellow who were both blind were early members of the church in Cuyahoga Falls. One winter night, they went to the meeting, and there was nobody else there, so they went up the steps. They were meeting in an upper room, and nobody else came. So Bruce said we read some passages or talked about some passages, and we had some prayer, and then we left. We got outside. He said, Van said to me, he said, Bruce, did we turn the lights off? He said, did we turn them on? And no. But we went into Bruce's store, and we walked along these appliances, and he came to this washer and so forth and so on. And now, George, this one does this. He was blind. He was going along there, putting his hands in the right place and showing me what all it did. The short of the story is, ladies and gentlemen, we left the store with a washer and a dryer. He didn't allow this to keep him from doing what he could do on his own. This, ladies and gentlemen, is adversity. And sometimes when we have adverse conditions, and we all will have them, believe me, we will all have them. Don't start a pity party because you're not the only one that has them. But understand that adversity are the things that humble you and help you to stand. Well, let's look at failure for a minute. Thomas Edison invented the incandescent lamp, and it was said that when he made his first demonstration of it, that somebody said to him, "Mr. Edison, how many times did you fail?" He said, "I didn't fail. There it is. It's burning, you know. It's there." He said, "I found 900 ways that wouldn't work, but there's the lamp." I was privileged to go to Hershey, Pennsylvania one time and to go through the Hershey chocolate plant. Now, you think that's a real treat. It's sickening. I mean, you go in there and there are these huge vats of chocolate slopping back and forth with these big panels. And it's fine. I love Hershey. I still do. And when we left, they gave us a couple of Hershey Kisses. I thought, I'll never eat chocolate again. It took me a day to get over that. But you know about Hershey? He was bankrupt in two other adventures in business before he ever discovered chocolate. Failure, failure, success. Now then, let's go to the Bible and look at some of these. Go back to 1 Kings, chapter 17, and we're told about a man with the name of Elijah. He comes on the scene very abruptly, just introduced as Elijah the Tishbite, prophet of God, and he comes on the scene during the reign of Ahab, which is probably the most rascally king that Israel ever knew. Had a wife that matched him. Elijah had a strong prayer life. He had unwavering faith. He was a man of dauntless courage, and he had wholehearted devotion to the Lord. And he has the contest on Mount Carmel when he finds out that Ahab has given sanctuary to the 450 prophets of Baal. Won't go into all the details of it. Read it in 1 Kings chapter 17 and 18. And he is successful there because the prophets of Baal could not get their idol God to answer. But when Elijah set up the sacrifice that he had and called upon the God of heaven, the God of heaven answered and consumed the sacrifice and so forth. And the people were now moved to forsake Baal and to embrace Jehovah. He was basking in the sunlight of victory, but there had been a famine in the land because of a drought that had been about 3.5 years as a result of Elijah's favor with the Lord. Now rains come, and this victory begins to pale as he sees advances made against him. And he runs 30 miles in the rain back to Jezreel, and that's where Jezebel is, and she threatens him life. And at that time begins Elijah's long journey down into the southern part of Palestine and into the wilderness of Horeb, the mountain of God. He gets there, and the Lord says, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" Elijah says, "Lord, they've thrown down your altars. They've killed the prophets. I'm the only one left, and you just may as well take my life too." What had happened? He considered himself a failure. He was weary. He was tired. And you understand something. The penalty of a tired mind is a tired body is a depressed mind. And Elijah was about at his lowest ebb. Now the Lord fed him, and then he said to him, "Elijah, I have 7,000 who have not yet bowed the knee to Baal. Take up your mantle and go on about your prophetic ministry." You know something else that Elijah had forgotten? He'd forgotten old faithful Obadiah, the single prophet up there who had stood against Ahab. Elijah considered himself a failure, and that he was, because he had taken his eye off the Lord and off things that he felt that he knew when the Lord could help him. And he comes to the place where he's ready for the Lord just to take his life. The Lord says, "Elijah, you go on about your business. I've got 7,000 just like you. You're not alone. Remember that, ladies and gentlemen, when failures come, and they will, when they come, you're not alone. Adversity and failure." Now then, Peter. I love to identify with Peter. I see in him a whole lot of me. He boasts about his love for the Lord. He attempted to fulfill his boast when he took his sword on the night of the Lord's betrayal and smote off the ear of Malchus, the servant of the high priest. They carried Jesus down to be in the trial before the Sanhedrin, and he follows afar off. And while he's there, the old saying is he warmed himself by the enemy's fire. And they began to say to him, "Why, you're one of his disciples." And you remember that the Lord had said unto Peter, "Before the cock crows, you're going to deny me three times." Peter denied. It happened again. Peter denied. It happened a third time, and the cock crew. About that time, the Lord leaves the house or the hall wherein the Sanhedrin had held him while they were doing that mock trial. And the book says that the Lord looked at Peter. And tonight we have about the best attendance that we've had during the whole meeting. And I can't tell you what a thrill that is. What do you suppose the look on the Lord's face was? I wasn't there. I don't know. But it must have cut to the heart on Peter because he went out and wept bitterly. You can't have any greater failure, ladies and gentlemen, than Peter had that night. But he wept the bitter tears. He repented. And it is Peter's sermon on Pentecost that is the one recorded when the door of faith is opened unto the Jewish nation and redemption is first preached. Later, you find him over in Joppa, brought in the house of a man by the name of Simon the Tanner. He's been tucked away there for the specific purpose that when the Lord finds this man, Cornelius, up here in Caesarea, and he finds there a Gentile that is an ideal candidate for the gospel, and he says, you send down to Joppa for a man named Peter. He'll come and tell you whereby you may be saved. Peter was so reluctant to go, he wanted a sign from the Lord. He went out and got witnesses before he would even leave to go with the men who came from Cornelius. But he stands before the house of Cornelius and finds a man who says, well, now we're all here to hear whatsoever things the Lord has said. And Peter was the one who opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles. From failure to success. Why? Because he didn't quit. Steadfastness, that's what we're talking about. Now then, look at how these work in our life, ladies and gentlemen. Adversity intensifies our steadfastness and gives us opportunity to know ourselves, our strengths, and our weakness. And it's important that we know that. We can make our boast as to what we would or would not do in certain instances. But the push comes to shove and the rubber hits the road when that instance comes, and now we find that somewhere we fail and we shirk, and now we begin to learn something about ourselves that we weren't as strong as we thought we were. So adversity does this to us. It gives us the opportunity to know ourselves, to know our weaknesses, to know our strengths, and to therefore help us to know when to be on guard when temptation rears its ugly head in our place. Now look at failure. Failure is the result of trying and not succeeding. Perseverance implies the ability to get up and go on. I want to read to you something that I took out of the Lakeland Ledger. That's a paper down in Lakeland, Florida. And it was from an interview by Michael Jordan, basketball player. Now, I'm not much into sports, but I read this and it convinced me of something. This was just after the Bulls had taken their fifth championship in 7 years, and the interview, Michael Jordan. No greater basketball player probably ever. And yet here's what he said. In my career, I have missed more than 9,000 shots. I have lost almost 300 games. 26 times, I was privileged to take the game-winning shot and I failed, I missed. I have failed over and over and over again in my life, and that is precisely why I succeed. You know what he was saying? The same thing that the man said who got put out at second base more times than anybody else trying to steal second base, was credited with stealing second base more times than any other man. He just never quit trying, and Jordan was simply saying, I'm a success because I lay it on the line all the time and I have my failures, but I never quit, and look where I am now. Tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. I am not going to be judged by the number of times I fail. I'm going to be judged by the number of times I succeed, and the number of times I succeed is in direct proportion to the number of times I fail and get up and try again. If I told you the times that I've sat in some place quiet by myself lamenting my failures and my shortcomings. Well, I don't want to do that, but I've done it. I'm aware of them, and they've happened. And there have been things that I have done that have hurt people. There have been things that I've done that have hurt me. And the things that I've done, I'm sure, that have hurt the cause. They're failures that I've made. But I forget them, and I keep reaching for what's out ahead. I live with the fact that there are plenty of brethren out here who, when I go and listen to them preach, I think, well, I'm sure glad they're in the kingdom, because they can do a lot more with the Lord than I can. But on the other hand, I get to thinking, it's like a spare tire in a car. I was called down to preach the Florida lectures one time, and because somebody had gotten sick and couldn't be there. Next year was there, and they said, we want you to read somebody's manuscript. He's had an accident and couldn't be here. I came home, and the brethren at Thayer Street said, we've had a couple of preachers that are fighting amongst themselves, and one of them's not going to be here because of that. Can you come and fill this place? And I told my wife, I just feel like a spare tire. Let me ask you something. How many of you would go from here to California without that spare in your tire, in your trunk? Even that little donut that they have anymore. I'll tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be a spare tire any day if it'll get me to heaven. This is adversity and failure. That's what we need in order to persevere and to succeed. These are the things that give us the reason and the strength and the fortitude and the sand to just continue. Now, understand this. We cannot appreciate food until we've been hungry. We cannot appreciate warmth until we have been cold. We cannot appreciate plenty until we have been in want. And we cannot appreciate the view from the mountain's top until we've walked the valley of failure. You want to look at the valley, at the mountain from the mountaintop, then walk the valley of adversity and failure, no matter how steep the climb, no matter how rigid it may be, and no matter how insurmountable it may seem. Just don't quit. That's what it's all about. Now then, 2 points I'll make, and then the lesson will be yours. This is the time when we spend a little time talking about how well we've been treated and how much we owe brethren and sisters for the way they've fed us and taken care of us. And if I spend as much time talking about that as I would like to, we would go over time and you wouldn't like that. But I want to say to each and every one of you who are here, some of you have taken us into your homes for delicious meals, good comradeship, but more than that, good fellowship. Some of you have stood back here in the vestibule and reminded me when a marriage or something that happened in our life years and years ago. I finally found one lady here tonight from Middle West Virginia that I remember something in our life that she's forgotten. And I've told her that after the service is over, I'll tell her about a big fib I told her one time. What are the benefits of all this perseverance? What's going to benefit me? Are you to stop and think, ladies and gentlemen, of people that you know who stand sort of head and shoulders above everybody else you know in the Lord's body simply because they have persevered and have gone on to accomplish things? I can think of a host of people that I just look up to because of that. And it's all because they've done the thing that I'm talking about here. Perseverance, steadfastness, is done through adversity and failure and all of the hardships that come upon us in the same way that a hothouse plant becomes the sturdy plant that produces fruit. My dad, God love him, always planted a lot of plants, tomato plants, you name it, in the spring. We had to dig the beds. We had to get everything fixed. There didn't dare be a lump of dirt in it bigger than my thumb. If there were, George, go back and rake it again. And we set out the plants in the evening. You know why? You can't set them out in the heat of the day. They'll die. And in the evenings when the mosquitoes are most plentiful. And there we were planting those plants. That hothouse plant had to have ideal situations because it had come from ideal situations. But once it had been out there and the rains had come, there had been a few cold nights, then there had been some hot days, that plant began to receive strength. And pretty soon the blossom come on and the fruit began to set on and the tomatoes were out there. And that plant was now sturdy. In fact, if sometime we go out to plow the garden in the spring and there would be what we call volunteer seed from that plant that were coming up in that cold ground. What does perseverance do for us? It builds character and strong personality. I want you to look at Hebrews 11 for just a minute. We're not going to deal in detail with a lot of the things that are said there. By faith, Abel offered unto God the more excellent sacrifice. By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, built or prepared an ark. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a land of promise, obeyed. By faith, they did this. By faith, they did that. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, it says, because he endured as seeing him who was invisible. How do you see what's invisible? With the eye of faith, that's how he saw it. And you look at them. The point is that they saw the invisible, they chose the imperishable, and they did the impossible. You know how they did it? Through adversity and failure and a faith in God that just kept them trying. And you think of some of those old Bible characters. And I think of one, Caleb, and I'll use him. Caleb, you remember, was one of the 12 spies that went in to spy out the land of Canaan. He came back and with Joshua stood against the other 10 who gave the false report. And the Lord said that now all of those who came out of Egypt, 603,550 fighting men strong, I believe it was, they're all going to perish here in the wilderness except two, Caleb and Joshua, because they had the right spirit. Later, after 40 years of wilderness wandering, they come up onto the eastern side of Jordan, going to cross there, go across into Jericho, and lay conquest of the land at the worst possible military vantage point. They're going to lay conquest of the land, and that they did. And they come now to this time to divide it up, and they come into the area of Hebron, and Caleb comes to Joshua, and he said, I was 40 years old when Moses said to me that there's a place for me in Canaan. This land has been promised unto me. My physical strength is not abated. My eyesight is not dim. It's now been 45 years, 40 years of wilderness wandering, 5 years during the conquest. And old Caleb says, give me my land. For 45 years, he looked for something that had been promised unto him. You talk about perseverance and steadfast. Ladies and gentlemen, read and saturate your mind with the narratives of biblical characters who are just like you. We put an aura about them as though they were superhuman. They were not. They were people like you, like me. When they cut, they bled. When they bumped themselves, they hurt. When they got hungry and famished, they suffered through it. They were just like you and me. But they accomplished great things because they trusted the Almighty. Now then, second thing, it will strengthen your faith. Jesus spoke in Matthew chapter 6, verse 30, and Matthew chapter 8, and verse 10, about degrees of faith. He talked about those who had little faith and those who had great faith. Now you have to understand something. No man is endowed initially with great faith, because faith is not given of God, but it is by our acquaintance with divine revelation initially. Any faith that a man has in God has to be based upon testimony that comes from God. That's where faith comes, by hearing. Now then, great faith is the result of personal experience with God on God's terms. When Abraham was told to go out and to offer Isaac and to make him a human sacrifice, that came at a time in Abraham's life when there had been approximately 20 years prior of Abraham's life in which he had done the things which God required, when he did the things that seemed so difficult to do, when he had personal experience with God on God's terms, that when this time came, he said, "This is the Son of Promise. This is the one through whom my seed's to come." And that promise has not been fulfilled. But I know one thing. God is able to raise him up and give him back to me. And on the basis of that, he was ready to slay that son until God stood his hand. It strengthened faith. And that's what adversity and failure, coupled now with perseverance and steadfastness, will do for you. You wonder why some people seem as though they can just be faithful regardless of what. Look at their lives, and they've had. I know this sounds a little bit like it's sectarian, but ladies and gentlemen, people have personal experience with God on God's terms. You do. You have it every time. There is a requirement of God and you fulfill it. You have it every time that there is a requirement of God or something that the Lord requires of me and there's an obstacle in your path and you overcome it. And little by little we go to have strong faith. I could talk a while longer. There's a couple more pages of outline. I'll give them to Keith. But ladies and gentlemen, understand something. We're on a journey from here to heaven. We're going to undergo a lot of trials that are going to seem as though it's not worth it and we just never can make it. You understand one thing. Perseverance and steadfastness says, "I set my goal on that which lies before, and I just will not stop. I may fail, I may have adversities that seem insurmountable, but I just will not quit." I know a man in West Virginia who was sick for a number of years, 5 years all told. As he began to regain his health, he had to do everything, learn to do everything all over, learn to walk, learn to drive a car, everything, all over again. There was a poem that he read, and he gave it to me, and I copied it down, I don't know how many years ago. But he said, "It isn't his form when he leaves the post that shows us the racer's skill. There isn't a promise or a word of boast that can prove his promise of will. But it's how he can stand the grueling grind and hold to a steady pace. It's how he can fight when he's lagging behind and forge ahead in the race. It isn't the halfway mark that tells how runners are coming in. Leaders can fail. Nobody knows who's finally going to win. But it's the power of sticking at any cost that measures the winner's class. It's his nerve when the race seems all but lost. It's the grit and the sand that he has. So keep going, no matter how bitter the pace, you still have a chance at the prize. Keep going, no matter how backward your place, there's hope for the runner who tries. Because it's the finish that tells how the race is run. It's that spurt at the end of the grind, and many a worthwhile prize has been won by the stayer who came from behind." I heard that it was said by Winston Churchill, in one of the darkest hours that England had during the bombings that the Germans were bringing against them. And he simply said, "I understand," on a radio broadcast one time, "Don't ever, ever, ever quit." That's the whole story. Don't ever quit. You get up tomorrow morning, you face the day, you take today's responsibilities, you do them the best that you can, you work it the best that you can, you entreat the Lord for strength, you bless the Lord for blessings that he gives you, and think of the things that he heaps upon you in the way of blessing and loving kindness and tender mercies day after day after day, and you just keep going until finally there's going to come a time when they'll take our bodies to the silent city of the dead, and there Mother Earth will open up and receive it. People will stand around, hopefully mourning and weeping. But in that case, I shall have long since been taken home to glory. Is that what you want? There's no doubt in my mind that that's what everybody in this audience tonight wants, and you can have it because of your pledge to the Lord, your commitment to him, your obedience to his will, your walking in his footsteps, doing everything that you can to grow in the grace and the knowledge and come to maturity and to the fullness of the measure of the stature of Christ in your life, go to heaven when you die. Brethren, don't ever quit. And if you're subject to the gospel call tonight, come while we stand together, while we sing. The incident with Mildred was, she became totally unresponsive, practically no pulse, no breathing. When this happened on August the 28th, in the 4 minutes that it took the medical people to get there, I was convinced she was gone. And they literally yanked her out of the car. We were in the driveway, we were in the garage of the car, and put her onto a gurney and put her into the back end of the ambulance. And for the next 4 minutes, I just paced up and down and probably chewed my fingernails and everything else. And they came out and they said, "We have a pulse now. And she's starting to breathe again." And from that time on, over a period of minutes and hours, she improved. Within a day, you would have thought there was nothing wrong with her. 4 days in the hospital and every conceivable test known to man, and I'm sort of inclined now that they made up some that they came out with, "We don't know." And they dismissed her, and on the top of the dismissal sheet, it said dizziness. My regular physician said to us, "It may have been a near fatal attack of arrhythmia. We don't know. If it was, we don't know why. When it will happen again, we don't know, if it ever will. And that's it." Today was an exact replica, almost to the letter, of what happened then. But we couldn't take the chance. We rushed her into the hospital. I called her just before I came over. She's resting easy. And admonished me to do my best. And said that she'd be all right. This sermon may not be as long as some of the others. On the other hand, I may revive, and who knows?